I'm Stephen Greenman, and I have a general dental practice in Westlake Village, California, which is a suburb of Los Angeles. I went to dental school at UCLA and first set up practice near the campus in West Los Angeles. I've been in practice for, it's going on 32 years. Graduated in 1981, and I first got some heard about Bill through a continuing education, kind of a potpourri seminar put on by one of the local private teaching institutes, aesthetic professionals. So I saw Bill there, and then I think I saw him in another location, maybe at the California Dental Association. And then started to think about where I was headed with my practice, and I felt like I was wanting to get out.
Well, you were 20 years into practice at that point, and
I was,
were doing well. You went into an area that, anytime you're within 5 miles of a dental school, you've got plenty of dentists. So it wasn't exactly a.
It was, and by the time I got. Be with Bill, I was no longer in West LA. I was still within 40 miles of the dental school. I was full time in my practice in West LA, and I would say I had a typical practice, and I was a fairly typical dentist, although I didn't really realize it at the time. I thought I was a cut above, but as far as extra services and extensive additional training, I'd really not received anything like that. Sure, I'd go to do continuing education, but I wasn't on a level that I am now, for sure. 10 years ago, I had a large staff that was eating up probably well over 30% of the practice income. My net on the practice was probably not much better than 20 or 25%. I was 46 or 47 years old, and facing the prospect of not being anywhere near financially independent enough to feel comfortable. And I felt that unless I made some significant changes, I was not going to be, that I was facing no retirement or a retirement that was going to be severely impaired. In terms of just being able to live, and live in Southern California. I mean, I was even thinking about moving to other locations in the country that were less expensive to live in. And I listened to what Bill was talking about and decided at a certain point that I was going to become a client. And then my thing has always been that if I hire a professional professional services, that I do exactly what that person recommends that I do.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. So you made the decision. Go on.
The decision. And so, I went to the summit meeting with Bill and Carolyn. And this was up in Sun River, at their home that they had in Sun River. Spent a couple of days there. Left with a prescription for what to do when I got back to my office, and one of those prescriptions was to reduce my staff. And I didn't waste any time. I believe I walked into the office on Monday, and at the end of the day on Monday, I let two people go, and I reduced my overhead from 30% down to 20%, and I really looked at my capital outlay to hire people versus what I knew I was going to be able to save or by increasing my bottom line. I wasn't really looking at if I was going to increase my gross in my practice so much as if I could reduce and improve my net. Then that would be fine, and improvements in my gross down the road, even better. So I was looking at a 10% savings in overhead, which at that time amounted to about $80,000. So it was a no-brainer to hire Bill because the return on investment was like...
This has been one of our philosophies for years, is that so many doctors are trying to outrun their overhead. They're actually just like a hamster on a wheel, and they're trying to outrun their overhead. And they have this idea, and it's a good idea, and actually, in theory, it works really well. I'm reading a book right now by How to Measure Your Life by a fellow named Christensen, and he's a Harvard professor at the Harvard Business School. And, of course, they work a lot on theories, and, you know, business plans are all wonderful, and people write up business plans, what their revenues are going to be, and then what their expenses are going to be, and then, of course, they make a nice-looking business plan all based on pretty much educated guesses and sometimes just plain guesses. And yet what we see in dentistry so often is the idea is there's nothing we can do. The only thing I can do is produce more. I produce more dentistry. And the interesting thing is that most dentists have already tried everything they can do to produce their or to produce more. But one of the things that – and it takes time. We can raise people's production, but it does take time. But if we put better systems in place, and that's something we showed Dr. Greenman how to do – when he was with us in Sun River with some better systems, because you can't just go home and reduce staff unless you have a more efficient way to work. And I think for doctors listening to this, you know, if you were to tell your team you're thinking of reducing the number of people, they would panic and say there's no way possible because they're all working as hard as they can. And they are doing what they do, but maybe you can change some of the things you do. And that's what Steve did so well. He actually took these suggestions of changing the way he worked so he was able to work with two less people. So now we've got the pressure off. Now we can grow the practice.
Well, let's talk about that for a second because, Bill, you're the author of Playing Your A Game, and Dr. Greenman, you clearly had a plan of action in place that you decided to implement immediately upon returning from meeting with Bill. The team members that you let go that first day back, they clearly weren't A players.
No. The plan was, well, the at Sun River, at the summit, we evaluated all of the employees, and I was asked to rate them on a scale of 1 to 10, and my wife was involved in that as well. And the plan going back was to cut anybody loose who was under a 9, and because the quality of the team is just so important. The attitude of the team, the curiosity of the team, the drive of the team really is what sets the tone for the practice. And so that it was fairly easy for me to determine who needed to go first. And then there were, I believe there was one or two others that were on the cusp and ended up being replaced just through natural attrition. But two were let go immediately, and some changes were made. One thing that was going on is that I'd hired a consultant whose whole philosophy was improving the growth of the practice by increasing and improving the recall system. That's the entire philosophy, but the philosophy was flawed because the costs of increasing the recall and getting more patients in to the hygiene department was no better than a wash, no better than a break even, and really it put a drag on my practice. So what I ended up doing is reducing the amount of hygiene hours that we were offering and put the responsibility on the hygienist to run her own practice. And so that was by doing that, I was able to eliminate two hygienists and a coordinator that was their exclusive front desk person, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And that philosophy is that if we increase the capacity, it will automatically fill with the demand of people wanting
right.
hygiene visits. And it's, you know, it's just like the baseball field, build it and they will come. And I agree, it's a flawed philosophy that
it is.
Just because we have it available doesn't mean that they're going to swarm into the office. So let's get the overhead under control first, and that's what you actually did real well. You know, Stephen, what by the time we finished that first year, what was your overhead percentage roughly? Do you remember?
Oh, by the time I finished the first year, it was getting below 60%.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my overhead before I started with Bill was in the, it was north of 75%. And then immediately after hiring Bill, and by the end of the first year, it was starting to nudge below 60%. 10% of that was from a reduction in staff, and then, of course, there were some other savings because we just weren't seeing as many patients. So there were some other savings that took place as well.
And the growth of the practice stayed, actually leveled off, but it actually started to grow some at that point. But it wasn't
right after
in
that first year. Right, exactly.
On you producing more dentistry, it's produced on, hey, you're already doing a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Let's make some money at what you're doing and then grow the practice and you'll really make some money.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the ways that we did that and kept things manageable is that we took control of our schedule. And but by doing so, was able to concentrate blocks of time to large production cases. And then, you know, then of course, then there was the other job that I had, which was to improve and expand upon my range of services. So immediately I embarked on some very intensive long-term continuing education programs. First thing I did was I enrolled at Aesthetic Professionals for the Comprehensive Aesthetic and Restorative Dentistry Residency, which went over 9 months. It was hundreds of hours of CE, clinical requirements, literature review, all of that, and I truly then became an expert on you know, restorative materials and also on the ability to provide comprehensive aesthetic cases. So that took off, and then Bill also advised that I get involved with some marketing because I had never done any. I had never done an ounce of advertising. And I'll never forget that I said, okay, I did a website. I think at the time I hired, it was Einstein down in San Diego. And within the first month of having the website up, I got a patient who is a big wave surfer who lives in Santa Barbara but spends most of his time in the South Pacific. I guess he's like a trust fund guy. And he came in and had a major reconstruction done. And that really opened my eyes to the power of marketing. So I've continued to do that. And as a matter of fact, you know, that's become a major part of my business plan is my marketing.
You see, Duke, one of the things that we see so often, I bring in a new client, and their overhead's just like Dr. Greenman up there in that 75-80% range, and you start talking about, well, doctor, you need more new patients, and you've got the doctor and their spouse, and they're saying, wait a minute, if we've got to spend more money on marketing, that means we don't take any money home. What are we going to live on? And so they can't do any marketing. And it's just like Dr. Greenman said, with the advice to go out and take a comprehensive class to make them a better clinical dentist, you see, again, when that overhead is up there at 75-80%, they can't do that. They can't afford, number one, they can't afford to take the time out of the practice because they're on this treadmill, and secondly, they can't afford the tuition, and so they can't see the possibility of doing that. Whereas if you get the overhead down, and now you build up a reserve of cash, and so a course comes along that you want to take, like the course at Aesthetic Professionals that Stephen did, he can do it without affecting his take-home money, so it doesn't affect his family, and it doesn't seem like this big sacrifice to do this. You know, my daughter right now is a dentist, and she's just starting her fourth year out of dental school, and she's taking a year-long course on implants. But the interesting thing is, you see, she runs her practice at about 55-60% overhead. And so that she has the money to do this. She has the money to go ahead and buy the equipment needed to place the implants without going to the bank and borrowing the money. And so many of her classmates are saying, well, how do you afford to take this class? And she says, well, I don't know how you can afford not to. I need to do this so that I can offer this service to my patients, but they all know this, but you see, with the high overhead, if they try to outgrow that, it's really difficult. But if you get the overhead under control first, now you can do these things.
Well, not only that, when you get the overhead under control, you get the training, you set yourself apart from the competition, and now you're in a position where you're not having to have your fee schedules dependent on the decisions of a third party.
Well, one thing I've been real proud of Dr. Greenman, he's added, not only has he added the more comprehensive cases, he's also added IV sedation. And I know this was really the toughest thing for him. As a UCLA grad, he had to go to the USC campus to take that course. Now, that was his biggest sacrifice he's made probably in his entire professional career, was to show up on that SC campus for a week or 2 weeks. But you're
going
into
Trojan territory over there.
We had to have lunch every day across from Heritage Hall, you know, where all the Heisman trophies are.
That's tough. And you see, the other thing is that so many doctors, they try to market, but my question is, what do you market?
Yes.
See, what do you market? And Stephen pointed this out. He says now, rather than trying to base his competitive advantage on fees, in other words, a lower fee than the person across town or next door or across the street, now he has some skills that he can actually go out to the public with, and they can understand, hey, this guy has something that other people don't have. And now he's starting to attract these patients that want specialized services. And I know recently, well, within the last 3 years, you've added obstructive sleep apnea to your treatment, and that's been an incredible thing for you. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
I think the first part about obtaining the vision was to set my priorities straight. I had always gone, for 20 years, I felt like I was subordinating my decisions based on what my staff wanted. I had to face them every single morning. That was a problem for me. It was too easy for me to say yes or to want to implement something new into the practice and having them dictate whether it was going to happen or not. I think the number one vision Bill gave me is that my main responsibility in my life is to myself and to my family. And once I got that straight, then I was able then to have a vision that, well, my business was going to be the source of how I was going to provide for my family, and that I was going to have a business that not only I could thrive at economically, but also enjoy going to every single day. So once I made that vision, then it was a matter of finding people that wanted to go along with me on that. And once I found the right people, then it seemed to all fall into place, so that when I decided to add services like IV sedation, as far as my training went, I took my entire team with me every single time. I think I was probably the only dentist there that brought an entire team with him, including my front desk person. We closed the office so that everybody was on board, and they were very enthusiastic about it. And I think that's where vision is, and that once you've made your decisions, that everything will flow from that. So having a vision statement, of course, I involve my team in the construction and the amendments to my vision statement as we go along, but everybody is on the same page. And that's key. Bill has always talked about adding services to our practices that set us apart, so that will attract people because of what we do, not based on how much we cost. He's always looking out for for his clients in that respect, in finding what is working, because he's got contacts with dentists, not just all over the country, but all over the world, and what's going on in dental practices that is really working and that's attractive to patients. And one thing he started to talk about probably about 5 years ago was getting into treating obstructive sleep apnea. And I then, based on that, went and got training. Again, I had to go to USC, Bill. Okay. At the dental school, and I was actually trained by a professor there who really made dentists treating sleep apnea, in other words, dental appliances for sleep apnea, really put it on the map and made it mainstream and made it acceptable to the medical community through his basic research that he had done. He's cited in any major review paper one would read about dental appliances for sleep apnea. And I got the training and felt I was ready to go ahead, but there was a process before I was able to actually make it into a significant part of my practice, because I was in many ways inventing the wheel, if you will, or I didn't know who the other experts were that I could go to that would teach me the business side of it. And once I was able to learn how to implement it into my practice and how to run the business side of it, it really took off, and I was able to add a significant amount of production to my practice without having to add to my staff, add to my my team. So it became a huge profit center for me. I think I can talk in general about how all of Bill's clients, or so many of Bill's clients, are very open to sharing ideas, what's working. There's now an online forum called Dental IQ, and there's we share ideas, documents, problems, solutions, just all the time. So Ira has been probably one of the biggest players in dental sleep medicine in the country for many, many years. I think Ira's probably been involved in it for maybe closer to 20 years.
How about 30?
30, okay.
Yeah,
really at the...
And this is the interesting thing that I think, too. It was about 10 years ago that we put Ira Shapira on a platform in a seminar that we put together called The Purple Cow. And we were basically exposing our clients to various things that they could do that would set them apart from all the other dentists in their community. And Ira Shapira was one of those doctors that we put on with sleep apnea. He'd been doing it at that point for about 20 years, and happened to be the only dentist who was actually on the faculty at Northwestern Medical School teaching the MDs about sleep apnea. And we put him on the platform along with some other speakers that were clients of ours who were doing different things that most dentists are not doing. All ethical treatments, all well within the scope of the dental statutes. And very interesting. And part of that is getting the dentist to open their mind a bit that, hey, maybe there's another way. Maybe there's something else out there that I don't know. You know, the thing that most of us do is we do what we know. And if we want to get better results, what most people do, and I catch myself doing this as well, is we do it harder. I do it harder. I put in more hours at it. But instead, what I've learned over the years, and I personally have a coach myself in my business, and one of the things I've found is that very often it's not doing what I already know harder, it's doing something different. And that's very difficult to do. It's the scientist who hones in on a hypothesis, and they literally will throw out data that they gather that does not agree with their hypothesis because they become blinded to any other possibility. And sometimes it takes someone outside the scientific community to step in and say, hey, how about this? And if you'll look back across the history of science, many of our great discoveries were facilitated by someone from the outside, or many times in a university setting, it's not the professor who's been honed in on a particular thing for years. It's a student who doesn't know any better, comes along and says, how about this? Oh, and it works.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that we do with these dentists, is we get them to think differently.
Yeah, I mean that's so true. Uh-huh. Getting back to sleep apnea, from there, I don't think I made it totally clear, but in 2011, it was pretty close to 25% of my gross income, and I had my best year ever in practice, you know, in the depths of the recession, and because of adding that service. And we continue to evolve, and because things change with that. But we're enjoying the heck out of it because it's one of the few things that I do, or that we do, that I can delegate practically 90% of it to auxiliaries. And see, I'm doing it as an adjunct to my practice. It's not the main focus of my practice. So in that respect, you know, I'm a little bit different because I'm still a restorative dentist. And in fact, when our sleep apnea patients are being seen, I'm doing my typical afternoon appointments that I would do if I didn't have the sleep apnea there. And it's delegated really to our gopher person who comes in the afternoon to clean up from the morning blocks and to help us to see, because we have a larger volume of patients in the afternoon. And that's another thing that Bill teaches us, is to structure our days in such a way where we can control our staff overhead and not have our appointment book eat us up and actually negatively affect our production.
You talked about that. You mentioned that earlier, the Blatchford block booking.
Block booking, yeah, it, right.
How much of what would you say in terms of that being a big part of your success? It sure sounds like it.
That's the way you control your overhead is to block book. If you're spending the morning where you're seeing 5, 6, 7 patients, then you're running like a hamster, like Bill talked about before, and you almost have to have a second chairside assistant in order just to keep up with the room turnover. And, you know, nobody has an office that's got 25 operatories. Most of us have offices that are a lot smaller than that. So by controlling how many patients one sees in the morning and restricting it to high production and large time blocks, then I can go through my morning, be very productive with just a single dental assistant nobody else, and then giving everybody their lunch break. That's when in this case, she goes to junior college nearby. She comes in after her morning classes, and she gets our office ready for the afternoon while we all take a break. So that's been huge, and I've maintained a very strict rule about maintaining the blocks, because what invariably happens is as soon as a dentist relaxes, and it happens in my practice as well, suddenly you're finding short, distracting type of appointments in that morning block period, and next thing you know, you don't have the block available for the patient who walks in and says, "Look, I got a wedding in 2 weeks, and I want to get my smile redone. Can you start me today?" That's very important that you have that ability to get people in, because these decisions that our patients make are oftentimes they're not impulsive. They've thought about it for a long, long time. But once they find the right person and they feel like they want to get going, then there is some impulsivity involved in that decision, and you got to be ready to do it. It was my employee that coined the phrase and used it at one of the training seminars by the time the patient walks down the hallway and gets to the front desk to make that appointment for the next, for this big treatment plan, many times they change their minds, and she called it the hallway of changing one's mind. Well, you've got to shorten that hallway, and that can mean, like, for a person who wants a big smile makeover, being able to clear your decks and be ready for them the next morning. And so I'm not afraid to have open time blocks. In fact, I know that I've got an open time block tomorrow morning, and it doesn't bother me at all. Because
right.
I know that if I don't have that open time block, I've got no chance.
Mm.
Okay.
It's part
That's
of
great.
Our philosophy. Again, it's part of our masterminding group, of course.
Yes.
One of our other doctors came up with a statement that I thought was brilliant.
Carson,
Carson Cooch,
it was
from Albany, Oregon. He said
uh-huh.
that he would rather go into a day with openings, there he has the possibility to reach his goal. Whereas if he goes into the day and it's filled with production that's less than his goal, he's already committed to not reaching his goal that day. And so he would rather have the openings tomorrow, just like Stephen just said, that, I mean, it's only 8 o'clock in the morning. Have openings tomorrow, it's okay, because we were going to see all those patients today. Some of them are going to want some treatment or need some treatment, and we can get them in tomorrow and take care of them.
Exactly. Nice thing. Yeah, that's great. And I've always had, I've never had a schedule that's been booked up weeks in advance, and I hear about this all the time from other dentists. In fact, in my early days, like, I was envious, like, how can you be booked up 6 weeks in advance? You know, you must be rolling in it. But I'm not so sure that was necessarily the case. And when I talk to other Blatchford clients, and sometimes I'll talk to potential Blatchford clients, or I teach at aesthetic professionals, so I'll meet dentists there. They're booked up way out there, but they're not making money. And many times, you know, they're booked up way out there because they're involved in third-party plans as well. And I can say that I have no contracts with any insurance companies. I got out of Delta Dental probably about 5 or 6 years ago, and that was probably one of the happiest days of my life. We made a calculation of how much of our income came in through Delta, and determined that hey, we can make up for that, and so we by having the higher fee, and we dropped that as well. So. We are a fee for service practice. We do provide insurance filing and support documentation. I'll write letters if a patient needs something like that done. I have no problem doing that. But our patients pay us.
That's
so
great.
We've gotten out of the insurance business, and we've eliminated, at least in our dental practice side, our accounts receivables. It's essentially zero, or off, usually it's a credit balance, because we also have rules about how we allow our patients to get into block appointments. And we have block appointments. Patients will make those reservations for them in the block, but our patients know how much that a treatment plan is going to cost, and they make a down payment, or in many cases a full payment, before they're given the appointment, and that's very important also to control. And we don't have any problems now with last minute cancellation of large. In large, expensive dental appointments.
Right.
I want to point out something
here.
Dr. Greenman is completely fee-for-service, non-provider. He mentioned the dental part. In the medical section, which is his specialty, sleep apnea practice, he does deal with insurance there. But I want to point out something to doctors perhaps listening to this. Becoming fee-for-service and changing that relationship with those dental insurance companies is a desire that many dentists have, and I have helped literally hundreds of dentists accomplish that, but it is not something that I even recommend or even talk about until they have the things in their practice in place that are going to make that work. Because if a doctor is doing insurance, he's a provider for several insurance companies, and that doctor decides, I'm just going to stop working with these insurance companies and be fee-for-service, they're going to suffer some real economic hard times.
Yes.
And the reason is you have to change the practice first. You don't be a non-provider and then slowly change the practice. No, the practice has to change. And, of course, we've already talked about one of those changes. And one of those changes is you have to be prepared for some of those patients who have been coming to you because you're a provider. And that's a blow to many doctors' ego to think that the only reason they're coming to us is because of our fee being low. And it's low because the insurance company is subsidizing it, or you've agreed to provide it at a lower fee. And some of those patients will stop coming. And if you're up there in the 75-plus overhead, you can't afford to lose a single patient. And so you have to get the net of the practice up first. And that's one of the first steps that I always put in place when a doctor wants to become a fee-for-service practice. First question is, what is the net income currently? and how much of that net income could you give up if it came to that? And when the answer is none, then I say we've got some work to do first.
Right. Now, Dr. Greenman, what do you say to the doctors listening to us today who are do-it-yourselfers? And let me just tell you something. I've spoken with hundreds of doctors who have tried to launch a new service like implants or sleep apnea, and it failed. Okay, and I've spoke with hundreds of doctors who have tried to make the jump into fee for service, and like Bill said, they kind of jumped out, put the horse out in front of the cart, and then failed that way, and then went back, and the staff was confused and so forth like that, and the block booking. They've tried the booking on their own. What do you say to the doctors who are do-it-yourselfers who think they can do this without the help of someone like Bill?
Well, they have to take a hard look at their own leadership skills and their desire and drive to be a leader. If there are do-it-yourselfers who have a clear vision and are good leaders and who don't work with Bill and do very, very well. But for most of us, we've got busy lives, we've got families that are needing us, and we want to be there for them as well. And so I encourage that if you really want to make the change, that you hire outside coaching, and then of course then your job is to follow it. And and Bill can tell you that he gets a lot of clients, and most of them do extremely well. I would say the lion's share do extremely well, but and especially the ones that follow the advice. Bill, you'd agree with that, right?
Exactly. If they follow the advice, it works. The thing is that just like anything else, a person can make these changes, but they probably won't.
Right. Right, and the other side of it is you can beat yourself up trying to implement change into your practice because you don't know how to do it, and so and Bill's always advised that if you want to do something different in your practice, or you want to add something, or you want to do something new, find somebody who's already doing it successfully and copy them, and so. Mm. By being a client with a Blatchford client, I've got access to at least 5-6 dozen dentists around the country that are doing things successfully that I may want to copy, and we're all open to helping one another, and that's really been huge, been worked out very, very well.
One of the things we always want to think about is. In this answer of doing it yourself, there's a lot of experimenting that goes on.
Right.
And I can't tell you how many dentists I've talked to over the 25 years that I've been doing this, that I hear the stories that, I tried this and I tried that and I tried, they tried all these things. And then I really haven't found one that works yet. And I said, the interesting thing is somebody like myself has the opportunity to watch literally hundreds of dentists try all of these various things and hear the stories and all that sort of thing. And we watch the results. And, of course, I see numbers, so I know what the real results are. I mean, you can look at a practice on the surface and think, wow, this is really great. This really works well. But when you actually see the numbers, and especially those bottom line numbers, you really can decipher what does work and what's not working. And I can say, I tell doctors every once in a while, I'll say, if you do that and it works, I'll put you in my next book. In other words, you'll be making history because it hasn't worked very well for anybody yet. So if you really want to do it, you can go ahead. And I won't tell you. I always promise I'll never say I told you so because that's no way to motivate anybody. But I will put you in my next book for breaking some new ground.
Well, I can tell you that I went through period. When I first got trained for sleep apnea, I went a year and barely did any sleep apnea cases, and it was discouraging. But I didn't give up, and I was able to learn from some other doctors who were very successful with it, and I continued to get training on it. and was able then to implement the systems that I needed in order to make it work. There's you know, some major components to it that all offices, I believe, must do. And however, when I meet with dentists that are you know, considering getting involved in it, oftentimes they're closed to adding certain technologies, let's say, that I think are key. And I think that's the danger of do-it-yourself. You get into this mindset where, well, you know better than anybody else. And I don't think that's any way to run your practice or your life. You must be open to making change and to doing new things. That's hard for many dentists. Bill and I are somewhat alike in that our personalities are that, hey, sounds like a good idea, we'll give it a shot, and if it doesn't work the first time, we'll just we'll readjust and we'll continue to work it, especially if we really believe that it's going to succeed until we get it down. Whereas many other dentists wait for all the pieces to be in place, and they think about it and they overanalyze it, and before you know it, it's passed them by. I think that those two personalities, a person has to be understand their personality. And one thing that we learn and we train on with some of the advanced sales courses that we take with Blatchford is we learn our personality type so that we can understand how we are, and when we're behaving in a way that may not be the best for us because it's our personality type, we can say, wait a second, I can't be like this, and that helps us to make that change. Hope I made sense with that.
No, you made perfect sense.
Okay.
And you also talked about where you failed. So,
yes.
And you shared with me before your first year of doing sleep apnea. I believe you told me you only did a half a dozen cases.
Right, I did.
And then in 2012, you had some months where you were doing a dozen cases a month.
Yeah, so starting in 2010, I really started to do a lot of cases. What I did is I began to do home sleep testing and invested in home sleep test technology, and I started to get involved with professional medical billers, and that was a challenge because the first medical biller that I began to work with wasn't very good, and it wasn't until I found the right medical biller that all the pieces started to fall into place for me, and then we developed our systems. And really, it's quite simple to do medical billing. You just have to be organized with your fax machine, and once you've got that down, it worked out very well. Yeah, and you're right, 6 to 8 cases a month, with the average case bringing in about $3,200. So it was a huge part of the practice.
One of the things that I do with these clients, Duke, is a lot of doctors will try something. And it's like Stephen said, the first year he did 6 cases. Well, I've talked to doctors, and they'll say, well, I tried sleep apnea treatment at one point, and it didn't do anything, didn't go anywhere, so I stopped doing it. Well, they stopped just short.
They did.
They stopped just short of making it work. They
right.
had done 90% of what they needed to do to make it work, but they hadn't done that last 10%. I actually work with, when I'm in Sun River, I actually work with a personal trainer. And generally, when I work out myself, I generally stop about 10% short of what I really need to get to that next level. But the trainer has me do one more set. And that's really what a coach does is, most of us will try something, work hard at it, and very often we get just on the cusp of making something work really well, and then we give up. We say, let's choose something different.
That's
right. A
coach
or an instructor pushes you.
Mm-hmm.
Different than this program. Yeah.
So just to button up the sleep apnea, and then I want to ask you a couple more questions and we'll let you go. From sleep apnea from that first year, which you had deemed, most people would deem a failure by most definitions, less than one case a month for a 12-month period, then you turned it around. You got
right.
some coaching from Bill, and it is now driving, you said, upwards of 25% of your profits and only taking 10% of your time?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
Because it's practically all delegated.
Wow.
You're working like a physician, not a surgeon. So you're looking at reports. You can have your staff do the interview and the talking to the patient, and I can literally walk in and get the main points and greet my patient, and then make the suggestion for any change in their appliance, and determine when I want to see the person again, and it's literally I take less time with my ongoing appointments with sleep apnea patients. I spend less time with them than I do with my recall patients.
Wow.
So we'll see maybe three or four in an afternoon. And even with new patients, I don't really have to spend much more than 10 to 20 minutes with a new sleep apnea patient. So overall, it's very doable with the right training and with the right technology. I think that any office can incorporate this because they've got a built-in client base of approximately 25%. That means one in four people that walk into your practice have a high likelihood of having obstructive sleep apnea. And then the job is to identify those people, which is easy to do, and then the next is to have the conversation, and that's where many practices, I think a lot of the do-it-yourselfers break down, because the do-it-yourselfers oftentimes aren't devoting the time that they need to for training to their
and,
team.
And this is
sales
great.
Skills.
This is, yeah, the sales skills, but this is great too, because this isn't just your opinion. I'm reading something here from the Academy of Sleep Medicine that backs up those numbers, the 1 in 4.
Yes.
And then they've also concluded that sleep oral appliances are the number one treatment avenue for mild and moderate sleep apnea and snoring.
That's the position paper of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, which is the credentialing organization for physicians.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Fantastic. And then you talk about the sales training, because I know, Bill, you can talk for this about a second, the training the team to actually promote this and present this to your patients. How, like you said, you're only spending 10% of your time with those patients. The team's doing it all.
Right.
The interesting thing that I have found is that most dentists believe that the only person who can present any treatment at all is the dentist, and there's only one person who can speak to the patient about what their needs or their wants might be, and that is the dentist. And I have found first off, at my own practice, when I practiced for 20 years, I found that my team could do every bit of that as well as I could. Now, I had to make the diagnosis. There's no question about that. I'm not taking that away from anybody. But as far as finding out what a patient wants, what their long-term goals are, what they've tried, and how's that worked for them, and what's the cost to them emotionally and everything of not doing something, and talking about budgets and doing that, can all be done by team members. Because my philosophy is the way you make money in a dental office is you keep the doctor's hands in a patient's mouth. And anytime you find the doctor's hands out of the mouth, the way I say it is the team isn't getting their job done. Because that's what the team does. The team's job is to help facilitate the doctor doing dentistry. And so we train. We spend a lot of time. As a matter of fact, we have in our coaching program, we have 4 days of seminar, and three of those are devoted to the concept of finding, teaching the practices how to communicate the value of treatment. And it's not by educating the patient. It's not by learning what I call cutesy little answers to overcome objections. It's sincerely finding out what that patient wants and why they want it, and then providing that to them. And team members can do this very often more effectively than the doctor. And this frees up a lot of time, and it's more effective. So that's been our whole philosophy on that.
That's great.
I want to ask something I'd like to talk about here. We should probably bring up on this, is how much Stephen works now compared to how much he worked before he started our program. I know he and I have enjoyed some trips to Alaska fishing. And by the way, I just signed up for that trip again. Ron wasn't going to do it, and then he decided to do it. And
oh.
I think you went last year, and I didn't go, but I'm going to go again this year. And
you had a grandchild about to happen. I think that's why you canceled.
That's right. That's why I canceled last year. But
last August.
This year I'm going. But Stephen's been taking August off now for the last several years.
Yeah,
that'd be an interesting thing to.
No,
talk
yeah.
About.
Can you talk about that? Because we, prior to you getting on the call, Bill, Stephen and I were talking about he took a Blatchford vacation in December.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that? About where you were 10 years ago in terms of your vacation time and your quality of life outside of the practice and burnout and so forth like that versus where you are in 2013 with vacation time and what that means to you?
Well, I can tell you that I was working, I was typically working before I got involved with Bill about four days a week, but I was working well over 200 days a year. Probably closer to 220 days per year. It was something like, you know, two to 3 weeks worth of vacation for me. Really, you know, like I said before, I was feeling the effects of burnout. Oftentimes, some days I just felt like I was working just so that I could meet payroll, let alone anything for myself. And that was just no way to be. When I reduced and I got my net under control, I also made the decision to reduce and to control how many days that I was working in the office. And the decision was to work to have six weeks of vacation. So I structured my my months into 15-day working day blocks, if you will. And I'd work 12 15-day periods, so I'd work approximately 180 days per year. That was in, and I went like that really through, not maybe about 2 years ago, I started to reduce those days when I began to take the month of August off, and it was really nice. I mean, in fact, you know, oftentimes by the end of that vacation, you know, I was thinking, hey, I can get used to this never working again. But then something would happen. I'd get back to the office, and after a couple of days of acclimation, I had, like energy like you couldn't believe. Like, I have it right now. I took virtually all of December off. If it's planned correctly, you don't take a hit in your annual production. Like I said, I took the month of August off in 2011, had my best year ever. So it's not a matter of just putting in the time. It's a matter of planning your time properly. And I have no worries about leaving. I used to worry, was my team going to goof off or not cover my office properly? I don't have any of those concerns anymore. I've always got, and I'm able to take a month off and actually have a team member live in the office answering the phones. And we answer the phones, even though I'm working this year, I'd cut down to 3 days a week. I do have a staff person in the office every day because we spend a lot of money on marketing. We spend a lot of money to get that phone to ring, and I have a real problem with not having having a recording answering my telephone during normal business hours.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's smart.
It's a matter of planning, and really there's no reason not to do it. Whether you take full 4 weeks off or take 3 weeks off, I would definitely recommend that you get a couple of extended vacation periods per year, because I think it's just essential to keep going, to keep yourself fresh, to keep yourself motivated, and to enjoy life. I mean, you know, who wants to, you know, wait? You know, I always felt that you'd be better off if you retired at 50 for maybe 15 years and then go back to work when you're older, because you're not going to be as up for traveling, you know, the older you get. So why not enjoy it when you really can do it, because you can always work. The thing about dentistry, though, is that it's a surgical skill, and physicality is a big issue with it. So you need to be able to mix it. You got to keep working, but you also need to do the things that you enjoy.
Agreed.
Yeah. So
yeah, that's
having that time off has been good. And this year I'm looking at and I'm going to talk to Bill maybe after the call, but I'm looking to maybe reduce my numbers of working days from 180 and reduce it by 60 days, and I want to get his thoughts on it.
Yeah, I'm going to encourage you to do it. We have several doctors who are down under 120 days a year, and it's working just fine.
Right.
So,
well, I was thinking, trying to do it with 144 days, but I started to work my calendar, and that's one thing that we do as Blatcher clients is I have my calendar set for all the way out through September or so, and certain things are already earmarked even into 2014, but everybody knows the calendar, so and the team knows the calendar, so everybody can act accordingly. And I was trying to maybe try to do it in with 144 days, but I wasn't able to work out I wasn't able to get that many days, so I decided to go down to 121 because that I knew, or 100, whatever it is, it's 11 times 12. That's more than 121. Well, anyway, that's how many days I'm going to be working.
It sounds like it sounds to me like from where you were 10 years ago to where you are now that you've actually, I know the aging process affects us all, but it sounds to me like you're actually in a much better place in terms of, you know, no burnout, much more relaxed, much more. Would you agree that you have much more energy today than you had 10 years ago?
Well, it depends on what I'm doing, but I think I have I'm certainly a lot more relaxed, a lot more confident, and have a lot more fun in my practice, and just in life in general. I don't go to bed anymore worrying if I have enough money in the bank.
Wow.
So not having that financial worry was huge, and
no doubt.
That translated, I think, into more energy. Yeah.